Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. As President Trump prepares for a trip to Asia, the White House says the threat from Pyongyang will be at the top of his agenda, with leaders and denuclearization of North Korea is the only acceptable outcome. If this is not achieved through pressure by economic sanctions and diplomacy, U.S. National Security Advisor General H.R. McMaster warns the United States will respond with what he said are all capabilities available to North Korean aggression. Islamic State has claimed that Saifullo Saipov, the 29-year-old Uzbek immigrant who killed 8 people in New York City earlier this week with a truck, is one of its own. Meantime, President Trump has been talking about sending Saipov to the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has appeared to indicate Guantanamo is not off the table.
Terrorists should know this. This administration will use all lawful tools at our disposal, including prosecution in Article III courts or at Guantanamo Bay. If anyone has any doubt about it, they can ask the more than 500 criminals whom the Department of Justice has convicted of terrorism-related offenses since 9/11.
Saipov, who came to the United States legally through a visa program, faces numerous terrorism charges related to Tuesday's deadly rampage in New York City. Demonstrators gathering outside Venezuela's National Intelligence Service headquarters demanding the release or at least better treatment of several hundred dissidents detained there elsewhere for months. The detainees are primarily students. This is VOA News. Turkey is anticipating who will succeed Iraqi Kurdish President Masoud Barzani following his announcement that he plans to quit. We get more now from Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
Ankara made little secret of its pleasure at Sunday's announcement by Iraqi Kurdish President Masoud Barzani that he is planning to step down. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan slammed Barzani for holding an independence referendum, which Ankara feared could fuel similar secessionist demands from its own restive Kurdish minority. Turkish presidential spokesman Ibrahim Kalın made clear Ankara is already looking to who will lead Iraqi Kurds going forward. A new tableau appears when the term of office of Masoud Barzani is not extended and there will be a transfer of his duties to Prime Minister Nechevan Barzani, Kalın said. Nechevan Barzani, a nephew of outgoing President Masoud Barzani, is widely seen by Ankara as the ideal future leader. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
United Nations refugee chief says the growing crisis of global displacement is the result of weak international cooperation and the inability to prevent, contain, and resolve conflicts. Filippo Grandi said a series of new crises has caused massive displacement, actual virtually in every region of the world. Myanmar's Rohingya are among the most displaced, 600,000 seeking refugees in Bangladesh since August. Carol Batchelor is the UNHCR's International Protection Division Director. She says stateless people are among the most bereft.
If you live in this world without a nationality, you are without an identity, you're without documentation, you're without the rights and entitlements that come, that we take for granted, even just being able to gather here today, having a job, having education, knowing that your child belongs somewhere.
UNHCR urges all states to facilitate naturalization for stateless minority groups that fulfill certain residential requirements, grant citizenship to children in the countries of their birth, and eliminate laws and practices that discriminate against people of ethnic and racial grounds. Despite this week's terror attack in New York City, the New York City Marathon will go on as planned on Sunday, world's largest by the number of participants, the race beginning running enthusiasts from all over the globe to New York City, more than 50,000 runners with an estimated 1 million spectators will take to the streets on Sunday. Get more news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November the 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The IMF forecasts a modest gain in African economic growth.
After a slowdown in 2016, the IMF says growth is expected to almost double this year to 2.6% and to reach 3.4% in 2018.
That's correspondent Henry Richwell in London. A group of five Sahel countries agreed to establish a joint military force to confront terrorism in the region. Uganda's parliament speaker demands an explanation from President Museveni over police treatment of members of parliament on October 27th. And Liberia's Elections Commission responds to allegations it conducted a fraudulent poll on October 10th.
We conducted free, fair, and transparent elections on the 10th of October. Yes, we've acknowledged that there were one or two challenges, especially on the part of our poll workers, but that does not amount to fraud or intentionally targeting any particular political party.
John Flomo is spokesperson for the National Elections Commission of Liberia. The United Nations says millions of people suffer discrimination and lack basic rights. And we'll tell you about plans to build the Great Green Wall across the Sahel region. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Economic growth among countries in sub-Saharan Africa is expected to rebound this year from 20-year lows in 2016, according to the International Monetary Fund's biannual report. But the Washington-based organization warns that despite the modest recovery, public debt is continuing to rise and soon could become unsustainable in some African countries. Henry Richwell has more.
After a slowdown in 2016, where the sub-Saharan regional economy grew by just 1.4%, the IMF says growth is expected to almost double this year to 2.6% and to reach 3.4% in 2018. One third of sub-Saharan economies are growing at more than 5%. Speaking at a news conference in Harare this week, the IMF's Africa Department Director, Abebe Aemro Selassie, said he doesn't expect others to catch up.
We're still going to have a situation where 12 out of the 45 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, people in those countries will not be enjoying any increase in per capita income. This is about 40% of the population, so a lot of work to be done to put in place the policies, policy environment to get growth back up to the 5-6% we need to make a dent on, significant dent on poverty reduction going forward.
Not all economists agree with the IMF forecasts. Too pessimistic, says Judith Tyson of the Overseas Development Institute.
They haven't really looked at the impact of the recent increases in commodity prices. And in particular, oil has moved up well over $60 a barrel in recent weeks. And there's quite a lot of optimism that it will remain at that level. And the IMF have forecast only $50.
That's a big deal for countries like Nigeria and Angola, economies largely dependent on the oil sector. Tyson says it's not only the price of oil that is underestimated.
For some of the specialist metals, particularly around the electric car market this year, there's been a lot of speculation. And those are produced in large quantities in a number of African countries, and they haven't really looked at examples of that. So, for example, cobalt is a major metal that's mined in Zambia and in the DRC.
The IMF also flagged growing concerns over public debt, now above 50% of GDP in half of sub-Saharan economies, just as the costs of debt servicing are rising. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
An ambush that killed four U.S. Special Forces soldiers in Niger recently drew attention to the deteriorating security situation in parts of the Sahel region of Africa. Maria Mandialo reports on the efforts by the group of five Sahel nations, Burkina Faso, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, and Chad, to establish a joint military force to confront terrorism threats in the region as representatives visited the United States this week to make their case.
The group of five defense and foreign ministers on a visit to the United States reiterated the dangers they face. Malian Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop spoke about the latest ambush on Tuesday.
Mr. Abdourahmane Niang, who is the member of the Malian Parliament and the chairperson of the High Court of Justice of Mali. He was traveling in the region of Tenenku, in the region of Mopti, and his car and convoy came under the attack. It was ambush. Unfortunately, the driver has died, as well as five soldiers who came at their rescue.
Job said this kind of attack has become common and they're facing a transnational threat in the region.
It is urgent to deploy the G5 Sahel joint force with the mission to combat terrorism and international organized crime, but also the need to work collectively to provide assistance and support to the G5 Sahel.
The United Nations Stabilization Mission in Mali, or MINUSMA, was established in 2013. France also has 3,000 soldiers in Mali in Operation Barkhane. Ivory Coast's foreign minister says the work of the G5 Sahel group will complement what already exists in the region.
Le Burkina Faso compte près de 1,800 hommes.
Burkina Faso has about 1,800 soldiers in MINUSMA in Mali, but we think that's not enough to protect our countries and borders. In 18 months, we've had 80 attacks, mostly in the borders, but two big ones in Ouagadougou, and has caused the death of 134, including some from the West. So this is a global threat.
On Monday, the Trump administration expressed its commitment to stabilize the Sahel region and support the G5 counterterrorism efforts.
We are proud to announce today that we plan to provide up to $60 million in bilateral assistance, which we will work with our Congress to identify, to help stand up the joint force.
Chad Foreign Minister welcomed the move.
The 60 million sont la première plus grande contribution.
This is the biggest contribution we've gotten so far, and we thank the U.S., but we hope that more money will be pledged at our upcoming meeting in Brussels in December so that this joint force can gear up and declare war on terrorism.
Commenting on the recent deaths of four American soldiers, Niger's foreign minister says his government is working with the U.S. to find out what happened.
We owe it to the family members of the dead soldiers, but also for us so we can draw lessons because this conflict, where these soldiers lost their lives, is not over.
He adds that terrorism has no borders or colors. It's a global threat that needs to be dealt with, a fight the G5 is committed to wage. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, November 3rd. Daybreak Africa time is 13 minutes past the hour. The National Elections Commission of Liberia has described as fabrication some of the evidence contained in the petition filed in the country's Supreme Court by three political parties alleging fraud and massive irregularities in the conduct of the October 10th presidential first round election. The court this week put a stay on all activities pertaining to the November 7th run of election and is expected to rule today, Friday, or tomorrow, Saturday, on the challenge. John Flomo, spokesperson for the Elections Commission, says the commission told the Supreme Court it conducted a free, fair, and transparent election that was attested to by international observers. He said while there might have been one or two problems caused by some poll workers, they did not amount to fraud or an attempt to target any particular political party. He hopes the Supreme Court will side with the Elections Commission.
We conducted free, fair, and transparent elections on the 10th of October. That was attested by national and international observers. Yes, we've acknowledged that there were one or two challenges, especially on the part of our poll workers. For instance, some voters found it difficult to find their voting places. We've acknowledged that and we've apologized and we said we'll improve on that. But that did not amount to fraud or intentionally targeting any particular political party.
As you know, these three political parties led by the Liberty Party complained. They indicated that some ballot papers had been found in septic tanks and some ballot papers had been buried in Grand Jida.
Those are not true. Those are false alarms. We announced even far before the polls on October 10th that each polling center of the 5,390 polling centers we have 550 ballot papers. There were reconciliations before and after the poll, and these parties signed on to them. So where are you going to get the extra ballot papers that have been burned? But we've discovered, along with the Laguna National Police, that they know your Kennedy ballot papers, those are bulk ballot papers. They took them, cut them with scissors, and then displayed them as though they were real ballot papers. So that was just quite mischievous. Guys are doing everything to have us discredited. But thank God, we're open. The entire world saw the election. We did not target anybody, and we would never target anybody.
The decision is now in the hands of the justices at the Supreme Court of Liberia. What is the expectation from the commission? Do you still think that the runoff election of November 7th should go on as scheduled?
We've done our part as per law. We conduct a free and open election, and we can only hope that the Supreme Court will see it as we've done it as per law. We would love to get these things done. The voters are waiting. On our law, the Supreme Court is the final arbiter. For us, they said we should have a stay order on every activity leading to the runoff elections. We'll stop everything, and we can only hope that they can allow us to carry on our election, because nothing was done to undermine the process or to target any particular party. And the evidence are clear. For us, we are not above the law. Whatever decision they come up with, we will abide.
How much impact do you think the stay that the court put on your activities would have on you meeting the challenge if you have to have the election on November 7th?
Well, the impact, like the chairman said yesterday, we were training, for instance, our poll workers, our electoral supervisors. We were distributing electoral materials. So these things have all come to a standstill. So assuming that we're allowed to go, well, the Board of Commissioners will make a decision.
If I hear you correctly, the stay that the court put on your activities has had some impact in terms of preparation for November 7th.
Well, it is not for me to say, but I pull it to you. For instance, you need to train poll workers. You need to get your materials in place and on time for 8 o'clock on the 7th. We've gone through this already. So from a fair position, it's like we have suffered some time and resources. But again, like I said, the law is the law, and the Supreme Court remains the highest court and the final arbiter of justice.
John Flomo is spokesperson for the Elections Commission of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The Speaker of Uganda's Parliament has demanded an explanation from President Yoweri Museveni for the actions of security forces when they beat up and detained several opposition lawmakers on September 27. The lawmakers were protesting against a motion to remove age limits from the Constitution, a move that they say would enable President Museveni to seek additional terms. Uganda's constitution prevents anyone above the age of 75 from running for president. Gerard Karuhanga is one of the opposition parliamentarians who was arrested and later released. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the security operatives should be jailed for breaking the law.
I think the speaker must have been disturbed about discovering that indeed it was special forces that hijacked parliament. Initially, she had imagined they were policemen and women, but then when she realized that the military had literally taken over, I think that must have sent some shockwaves. And then I think she also realizes that that makes her equally unsafe in her own house. So it is an indicator that certainly this regime can no longer hold together, because you have a whole arm of government, the judiciary, which now apparently seems to be very disturbed about what transpired in parliament.
Some supporters of the government or the ruling NRM are saying that parliamentarians were behaving unruly. They were undermining even the sanctity of parliament, fighting in parliament, and that is why special forces or security operatives have to be brought in to bring some form of normalcy in parliament. What is your reaction to that?
There has been completely nothing shortly before the unfortunate intrusion of those special forces. Before they came in, there was no entity who was even abusing the other, just even by use of words. So it was not until these fellows came in and they started roughing up and in a rather brutal manner carrying away some of our colleagues. That's when people got up and said, "Well, you know what's going on?" And so it was more self-defense as opposed to sparking off anything. Because the speaker clearly said, "I give you 30 minutes and return, the following members should leave parliament," that she had suspended. Even 5 minutes had not passed. That isn't true, because she was even still at the exit door. Because and then these military chaps just came in like a swarm of bees, and they were really, really violent, and that's how they agitated everyone, and that's how the chaos ensued.
Jero Karuhanga is an opposition member of Uganda's parliament. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. Leading experts from Africa and beyond met last week in Ivory Coast capital Abidjan to plan a strategy for the Great Green Wall initiative involving the planting of a wall of trees across the Sahel region. Kumba Sao, coordinator for the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, talked to Ricky Stryak about the progress the program has seen and what they hope to accomplish in the future.
This is unique. This is beautiful. The objective is to enhance African Great Green Wall contributions to the climate change adaptation and mitigation in the dry lands of Africa, and all this by 2030, you know, in support to the Sustainable Development Goals. And by doing so, we'll try to support countries in the implementation of their nationally determined contributions to which they all engage themselves to do something. The aim in general is to mobilize technical, financial partners, countries, all together around this Great Green Wall initiative.
Your release said that early results in land restoration are encouraging. Can you tell me some of those specific results that you've seen from the Great Green Wall?
Let me give you an example on what was done in terms of land restoration in the northern Niger to make degraded areas productive again, because this is what we're talking about, degraded land that we make sure they can again produce something people can use to feed themselves, but also as economic opportunities in a region that is highly affected, for instance, by migration, for example. The seeds we provided to those communities around Tera, which is a small village in the north Niger, involved in land restoration activity since 2013. They were selected based on extensive village consultation. Seeds were planted in village nurseries. And since 2013, 5 nurseries was established around Tera. Now they produce 100 seedlings per year.
That was Kumba Sao, coordinator of the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. The UN Refugee Agency is calling on governments to grant basic rights of citizenship to millions of stateless people who suffer discrimination, exclusion, and persecution. The UNHCR is making this plea on the third anniversary of a 10-year global campaign to prevent, reduce, and eradicate statelessness. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA at the launch of a new report in Geneva on the world's stateless minorities.
The Rohingya represent the largest stateless minority group in the world. Although they have lived in Myanmar for generations, the government does not recognize them as citizens. They are forced to live on the margins of society and are denied the most basic rights enjoyed by Myanmar nationals. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have fled to neighboring Bangladesh to escape violence and persecution. The UN Refugee Agency reports there are more than 3 million stateless people around the world, with about 75% of them belonging to minority groups. The agency's I Belong campaign to end statelessness highlights the reality that these individuals do not belong anywhere. Carol Batchelor is the UNHCR's International Protection Division Director. She says stateless people are among the most bereft.
If you live in this world without a nationality, you are without an identity, you're without documentation, you're without the rights and entitlements that come that we take for granted, even just being able to gather here today, having a job, having education, knowing that your child belongs somewhere.
Progress has been made in reducing statelessness since the I Belong campaign began 3 years ago. Thousands of stateless people have been granted citizenship in places such as Thailand, Central Asia, Russia, Kenya, and West Africa. But the job is far from over. The UNHCR urges all states to facilitate naturalization for stateless minority groups that fulfill certain residential requirements, grant citizenship to children in the country of their birth, and eliminate laws and practices that discriminate against people on ethnic and racial grounds. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Friday morning to you, Samson.
A very good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the CAF Champions League Cup final, as both Al Ahly and Wydad Casablanca's coaches are determined to win the second leg of the African Champions League final on Saturday in Morocco. The Egyptian giants, who failed to benefit from the home advantage and held to a 1-1 draw last weekend, need to score away at the Mohamed V Stadium in Casablanca on Saturday to lift their favorite trophy for the first time since 2013. Staying with CAF matters, Accra, Ghana will host the 2017 CAF Awards on Thursday, 4th of January 2018 at a yet-to-be-named venue. Now to the Russia 2018 World Cup qualifiers. Egypt's Mohamed Salah will not be part of Egypt's final World Cup qualifier against Ghana on November the 12th. Egypt coach Hector Cooper has been criticized for over-relying on Mohamed Salah. Uganda has begun preparations for the last group game of the 2018 World Cup qualifier against Congo-Brazzaville. Uganda Cranes interim head coach Moses Basena is relishing what could be his last days as coach of the side, but believes his record since he took over the team can earn him the job on a permanent basis.
That is upon the appointing authorities, upon FUFA, to decide on which way to take. What I must tell you is that I'm one of the applicants. And that's it.
Elsewhere, when South Africa meets Senegal in a replay of one of the qualifying matches for the 2018 Russia World Cup, a bulk of the players will come from two domestic clubs, Mamelodi Sundowns and SuperSports United. And for coach Stuart Baxter, having domestic players feature for the national team is key to developing football on the continent.
This game against Senegal will give those five SuperSport players massive experience. The game in the final will give our national players massive experience. And it's a win-win situation. But what we've had for far too long is that their players and our players, you know, we get them, and if you don't give them us, you're not patriotic. And that, I think if we've got that relationship that we are partners in this, then we can give them the add-on experience to help them. And that maybe is the difference between semi-final and final.
And now to rugby news, and we stay in South Africa, where South Africa rugby national team coach Alistair Kotze believes he has a settled squad that will be able to overcome the threats posed by Ireland, France, Italy and Wales when South African national rugby team, the Springbok, begins its tour of Europe.
The conditioning, I'm so pleased with. Last year, this time, very same field, only two players could pass a fitness test. This time around, a whole squad of players are really in good condition and in peak shape.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The National Elections Commission of Liberia has described as fabrication some of the evidence contained in the petition filed in the country's Supreme Court by three political parties alleging fraud and massive irregularities. And that's it for this Friday, November 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very, very good weekend.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal.